Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
You know, if you didn't know better, you'd think Wes Moore was invented by a Hollywood scriptwriter. His story's that extraordinary, that inspiring. Army officer, Rhodes Scholar, financier, best-selling author, anti-poverty warrior, and now the first black elected governor of Maryland, and that actually cheats his story. You'll have to listen to this conversation to hear the rest. Wes Moore, Governor-elect Moore, it's a pleasure to be with you. I've been wanting to talk to you for a very long time, but I know you've been busy for the last year and a half, so it's good to catch up with you. I'm not sure you're less busy now.
It is so good to catch up with you, and it's great to catch up with you in this phase as we're getting ready to actually govern now. This is good. This is exciting.
Yeah. Well, as we were discussing before we started rolling, if you're doing this right, that's the payoff, the chance to actually accomplish things. Let's talk about your story, which is quite a extraordinary story, and then we should talk about where you go from here, where Maryland goes from here. But talk to me about your family and your deep back family, and then let's talk about your parents, who both of whom, in their own way, played such an extraordinary role in your life.
I knew from an early age that I wanted to devote my life to service, and a lot of it was because of my family and my family's journey, and my life in many ways has just been littered with the consequences of bad policies and littered with the consequences of inequitable policies, and we're literally some of the first memories that I have when I was growing up, where I only have two memories of my father, and the second one was when he died in front of me because he didn't get the healthcare that he needed when I was just months shy of my fourth birthday. Where some of the earliest memories I have was when I was 11 years old.
I don't want to interrupt, but I want to ask you about this because this, as I was reading your story, this was so striking to me. And your dad, both your parents were in the broadcast sort of journalism realm. That's how they met. Your father had a sore throat that wouldn't go away. Your mom sent him to the hospital. They looked him over and sent him home. Is that right?
Right. And when he went to the hospital, there was assumptions about whether or not he had insurance. His head was tilting and bobbing back and forth, because what they didn't realize was that he was suffering from something called acute epiglottitis, which is essentially where in the epiglottis in all of our throats, every time we breathe or chew or talk, the epiglottis lifts up and it allows air into our body. With acute epiglottitis, so essentially what it was is it becomes so swollen that it can't lift on its own and your body essentially suffocates itself.
And he was struggling to get air, huh?
He was struggling to get air.
And their assumption was something else, because here was this African-American guy in the emergency room. What do you think their assumption was?
I think that the assumption was just simply that this was not worth further investigation. Literally to the point that when my mom got there, they asked my mom, is your husband prone to exaggeration?
Mm.
That was the assumption, that he was exaggerating. And he was asked to leave the hospital with the instructions to go home and get some rest. And if it got worse, to come back. And literally hours later, he died in front of me.
Tell me about that, because you say it's a memory. Three-year-olds don't generally have that many memories. But that one obviously was so horrific, so vivid. What do you remember about that? Because my heart just broke when I saw that.
Memory that I have was he was upstairs. We lived in a small home in a place called Tacoma Park.
Mm-hmm.
And he was upstairs getting some rest, as they instructed him to do. And I remember as he was coming, I heard him coming down the steps. And so I remember going to the steps to go see him as he was coming down the steps. And the only thing that I remember was him collapsing down the steps. And then the thing that I remember is a crash coming in from where my mom was inside the kitchen, because she was cooking something and she heard that and then dropped the pan or whatever she was cooking. And I remember hearing, watching him crash and then hearing a crash come from the kitchen, and then just clouds, and not even understanding what was going on or what this chaos was. I literally remember watching him tumble down the steps. And that was a memory that I have of him. And literally to the point that I didn't understand what was happening or what was going on, where, at his funeral, I went up to go view the body with my uncle for the last time inside of the casket. And my mother tells a story how I asked my father, if he was going to come with us, because I didn't understand why he was laying in there.
Mm.
So none of this, these were literally some of the earliest memories that I have of watching, where my father was very much left behind in this process. There's no reason that he should have been laying in that casket on that day. And I watched how, it didn't just define the level of confusion and frankly, the level of anger that I had coming up. It also defined how life was now just irreparably changed for my mom, who was now, and she was an immigrant to this country. She immigrated to this country from Jamaica, with now had three children that she now had to figure out how to raise on her own.
Where are you among the three in the order?
I'm the middle and the only boy. I have an older sister who's about 6 years older than me, and I have a younger sister who's about 13 months younger than me. And so for my older sister, she actually, more than myself and definitely more than my younger sister, understood what was going on and what happened. And I think for her, it was that much more complicated, because, the confusion that I had about what was going on and why all this was happening and where was my father and what was happening and what happened to him. Unfortunately, I think for that time in my sister's life, she's that time around, 10, 11, she understood it clearly. And I think that loss, was not just palpable, but I think even for her, it showed itself in a lot of ways. And she got older as well.
Your family moved from, Tacoma Park, to the East Bronx in the aftermath of this, to be with your mother's family. Talk about that and the sort of change in your life.
I think my mother struggled significantly, because just out of nowhere, unexpectedly and in a very unprepared fashion, she was now going to be, this single mom who was going to raise three kids on her own. And she struggled because, one, she didn't trust the neighborhood. It wasn't a great neighborhood that we were coming in, but also, she was trying to figure out how is she now going to navigate this new world, with her children. And she sought refuge from the only place that she knew where to seek refuge from. And that was her parent. Mm-hmm. And my grandparents, they lived in the Bronx, right off of a place called Gun Hill Road.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather was a minister. He was a minister whose story is actually really remarkable in the fact that he was the first one on my mom's side of the family born in the United States. But when he was just a toddler, it was a Ku Klux Klan that actually ran him out of the country. But he eventually came back to this country, went to an HBCU, and he became the first black minister in the history of the Dutch Reformed Church. So he and my grandmother, who was actually born in Cuba, immigrated to Jamaica and then finally came to the United States with her husband at the time. They had this small home in the Bronx. But I would say, even though it was a small home, they figured out a way to make it big enough for all of it.
Yeah, quintessential American story. My dad was an immigrant from Eastern Europe and landed in the Bronx, but a few years before probably your family did. Did the absence of a dad, and I lost my dad when I was 19, so I was a little older, but still, the absence of a dad, you had a strong figure in your grandfather. Tell me how the absence of your dad impacted on you.
I think the absence of my dad still impacts. And it's partially because I think that, you know, there were so much that my mom could teach, could teach me and did teach me. Mm-hmm. But that absence and the uniqueness of what it meant to come up as a young man, to come up as a young Black man in a community that didn't always look kindly on young Black men. She could never teach me that, right? She could advise, but she did not, that mm-hmm. didn't come inherently, that wasn't inherent to her. And so there was so many things that I then had to either learn on my own, or I had to learn from the people who were willing to teach me. And so it really did kind of, you know, lead to this larger belief that I have. And I think for a lot of the work that I've done as I've come up is that understanding that our kids, and particularly, you know, for our young boys, they're going to learn, but the question is who's teaching them mm-hmm. and what are they learning? And so I think for much of what, for a lot of my childhood, was exhausted by this idea of finding yourself trying to, you know, trying to fit into the areas in a way that could keep you both safe and accepted, but knowing that sometimes those two things were at a head and yeah. those two things challenged each other. And I think those are some of the things and some of the challenges that I had when I was coming up that I had to, you know, learn the hard way now.
And challenges so many, particularly not exclusively young Black men face today. I mean, I think this is a fundamental issue. The lack of a father, the lack of a strong male figure has plagued a lot of young men.
Well, we saw it in my neighborhood as well, right? Where, and they were for different reasons. Mine, because he couldn't, in some cases of some of the other fathers, it was for different reasons. But I remember for my crew, when I was coming up, I remember there was, you know, of the small group of us that were coming from the Bronx, one of us had a father in the home. Hmm. One. And so that dynamic, you know, was something in that feeling of where, you know, we were coming up with moms as really being the head of the household and the sole person that you were then leaning on, relying on, was a shared dynamic for many of us who came up together. And so while I don't know if I fully appreciated at the time how important, you know, my grandfather mm-hmm. was at the time, because he was very much not just a pillar of my life, but also a pillar of a community. I also know that absence that I felt of having my dad not there, it was real, and that hole, you try to fill it with a lot of things that oftentimes became either counterproductive or dangerous.
Yeah, and your mother recognized that, and she took you out of the public schools, put you in the Riverdale Country School, which is quite an exclusive place. Tell me about you kind of lived in two worlds there, and it didn't go all that well, I guess?
You know, it was funny because, you know, it really, as soon as we came up there, to New York, my mother was trying to find a way to a different place and space for me. And, you know, she always had heard about this school called Riverdale. And Riverdale was a place that was right on the Hudson River. It was the school that John F. Kennedy went to. It was also a school that she didn't think for a second would be the, you know, a place that her kids could go to. But, you know, my mother, and I don't know if I know, I don't even fully appreciate the sacrifice that she made, because my mother was working multiple part-time jobs. In fact, you know, right before I got out of there and got sent to military school, she was working three different jobs in order to get what she needed in order for this to be real, to the point that she was waking up You know, she'd wake us up as we were heading off. She was out the door before we were leaving for school. My grandparents were the ones who were bringing me to the train station and then taking the train up to, you know, taking the multiple trains and buses that it took to get to the to Riverdale. And by the time my mom got back home from her last job, oftentimes we were already asleep. And so that was a dynamic.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. Did you go ride the trains and buses by yourself?
That was actually part of the problem, because what ended up happening was I didn't make it to school. And so it was way too easy to find something else to do. And so, you know, I'm at this school in a school called Riverdale, where, you know, I very quickly found myself too poor for the kids in school. And then when I come back home, I now find myself too rich for the kids in my neighborhood who didn't understand why I was now going to school across town. Yeah. And so you find yourself in this middle. You find yourself where you're almost trying to adapt to your different environments and to your different areas, which is maddening and incredibly frustrating for a kid, you know, at that age. And so you're right, where the trains and the buses that I would take in order to get to the school, where that played an important role is my mother didn't realize just how many days I was missing, because I'd get on the train and I'd go somewhere else, or I'd skip the day. But also what my mother didn't realize until I got sent away to another school was, even though the teachers knew I was missing school, as they would say, this class worked better when I wasn't there. And so they never.
Because they thought you were disruptive.
And they didn't think I was disruptive. I was disruptive. So as they said, the class was better when I wasn't there. And so the idea of being able to flag my truancy wasn't high on their priority list.
And so your mother's solution to that was the Valley Forge Military School. And how did you feel about that when she told you that you were being sent away to military school?
I know I felt how most 13 and 14 year old young boys are getting sent to military school. And that's the thing. My mother had been threatening me with military school ever since I was 8. Like, she would look at my grades and all this stuff, and she would, like, you know what, I'm going to send you away. And then when I was 9, you know, she started getting brochures to show me she wasn't playing around. And I felt blown wrong, because I was like, there's no way she's ever going to send me. And then when I was 13 years old, was when my mom said, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to send you away. And I was like, you know, I was like, all right, mommy, I'm going to work harder. And then she's like, no, you're going next week. And she started packing my stuff up. And I honestly thought that this was some, like, beyond scary straight, right? Like, you know, we're going to drive around the block, and, you know, I'd have to assure I was, you know, tried and all the kind of stuff. And she sent me back home. And she literally drove to Pennsylvania and dropped me off at this military school. And when I first arrived at that school, I still thought that this was just a very bad joke. And I was telling the people when I first showed up, I was like, listen, I'm not going to be here long. You don't have to waste your time on me. We're sorting out the paperwork right now. You know, so really, I was ready to go. And I ran away 5 times in the first 4 days of military school, because they had these big black gates. And every time they'd yell and scream and tell us there's a train station out in Wayne, Pennsylvania, I would just take them up on their offer and try to find the train station and run out the gate. And then the second to last time I tried to run away, it was actually because they drew me a map that was fake on how to get to the train station. And they just literally watched me do circles in the woods, to try to find this train station.
Kind of cruel.
It was very cruel, but I got to tell you, if I'm honest, it's the same strategy I used when I became a leader at the school later on for a lot of the young kids who are coming on board, to watch them do those same circles that I did when I first got there. But I hated that place.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about this, because kids don't understand. Your dad dies, he's gone. So you've lost your dad. Now your mom drops you off and you're separated from your family. I mean, did you feel a little bit like you had been abandoned there? I know she felt it was for your own good, but how did you feel?
I think you just hit the nail on the head. There's a level of abandonment that you feel, right? There's a frustration and an anger that you feel, where I remember, David, I remember being out in the woods that one time when they actually drew me a map on how to get to the train station that I thought was a real map. And I was literally going out in the middle of the woods and didn't realize that the map was, they were literally just playing a joke on me. And I remember at some point when I was in the middle of the woods, I was terrified because I was, you know, both because I was hearing a bunch of noises and I thought it was like snakes and bears or whatever else was chasing me in the middle of the woods. But also I was just, I was angry and I was scared. And I felt like I was trying to explain to the people there what I needed. And what I needed was to go home. But I felt like they weren't hearing me and neither was my mom. And so you do, you feel very alone. And I do remember that, that time when they found me in the middle of the woods and they brought me back to campus and I'm crying and they're laughing and they told me I was allowed to have one phone call. They said, call whoever you want. We don't care, but you got 5 minutes. And I called the only number that I had memorized and that was my mom. Explained to her, I'm sorry. I want to come home. Can you come get me and all this kind of stuff? And she stopped me in the middle of my diatribe and she said, too many people have sacrificed in order for you to be there. People are rooting for you and you have to understand it's not all about you. And that night, I don't think I really understood what in the hell she was talking about. But I just wanted to go home. But I think that as those days went on, the idea of understanding sacrifice and people were making for me, the idea of when I later on learned that my grandparents had actually mortgaged and taken money out of their home in the Bronx to help to pay for that year because there was no way my mom could have done it on her own. The level of sacrifice that people were making on my behalf, I started to get a better understanding of, and that level of aloneness that I thought I existed in, I realized that that entire time, you know, I wasn't alone. I had a whole lot of people who were pouring into me in a way that I didn't fully understand or appreciate.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now back to the show. But you ended up excelling there. And was that the turning point? Was that, I mean, when did you start sort of seeing yourself in that environment, feeling it, becoming confident? Because you ended up being a huge leader there and, you know, class president and excelling in athletics and in all ways becoming sort of a model student. And it feels like there had to be some sort of transition. Was that the transition?
Honestly, I think the transition for me was leadership. And, you know, because people sometimes will say with military school where they're like, you know, oh, it's great that they teach you discipline or they make you do push-ups or they make you wake up in the morning. And all that is true. Yes, you'll wake up early, you'll do push-ups, you'll do all that stuff. But that for me wasn't the transition. For me, the transition was the first time that they put me in charge of something. They're going to put you in charge of something and there's this graduated sense of responsibility and they start with something that's small, right? They start with a small unit of accountability. Make sure a hallway is clean. Make sure the trash cans are empty. Make sure whatever it is. And then if it's done right, they'll say, you know, congratulations. And if it's done wrong, they'll say, Lord help you. And then eventually once you do well, they'll give you more responsibility. And so there's this graduated sense of responsibility that happened that I think was really important and powerful for me, because when you now feel that you're accountable for something, when you feel like you're responsible for something other than yourself, your behavior begins to change. And so that was, I think, one of the biggest turning points for me when people say it wasn't about the first 6 weeks. The first 6 weeks, they're just hazing you, right? They're breaking you down as an individual so they can build you up as a unit. But that was the entry point. The thing I think that really changed me once I got there and where even at the end of my first year, where I had a chance to leave, I had a chance to go back to school in Maryland. But the thing that I think that really changed me at that point was I now had leadership. And I think that's what kept me there throughout those years.
You also, I guess, met some role models there. That's where you first came across Colin Powell and others. Tell me about that.
Well, and, you know, and I think about it even in context of, you know, when I finished high school, I actually was was doing pretty well academically, and I was a cadet company commander. So I had 125 cadets under my command as a high school senior, right? And I was a pretty good basketball player, and I was getting scholarship offers to go play college basketball. And I remember at that point having conversation about wanting to join the Army and, you know, saying that, you know, I really want to lead soldiers and I really want to, you know, be in charge of, be in charge of Army units. And one of the biggest reasons for that and the motivation behind that was exactly as you said. I think about some of the mentors that I had in my life at the time, and particularly, frankly, a lot of the men that I had as mentors, they had something in common. That was the uniform of this country. Instructors or ROTC, junior ROTC people who were members of the military, members of the Army, who then were our teachers, our instructors, our chaplain. And so the common thread that for so many of the mentors that I had in my life up until that point, the common thread was they all were in the Army. And so for me, when I became 17 years old, and I started thinking about what is I want to do in my life and what are things I want to see, the answer became pretty easy. It was, I want to join the Army.
One of the things that I read somewhere is that you told a classmate, or maybe this is the stuff that people make up, but you told a classmate that you wanted to be the first Black president. And if that's true, I just wanted to apologize for you for having ruined that, helping ruin that for you, because you can't be the first Black president. Did you begin to have an interest in politics then?
I don't think that's true. So I'm not sure where that person heard that from. But it was around my later years in high school when I started to think about what was the impact of history and policy. I mean, when I was younger, I remember when I was a high school senior, the thing I really wanted to be, I wanted to be an army officer, right?
Uh-huh.
I wanted to lead soldiers because that was a thing that I felt I was good at. That was what the military mm-hmm. school had trained me for. But I remember it was around my sophomore and junior year of high school that I met a gentleman named Colonel Mike Murnane, who's my social studies teacher. And, you know, I really have more of a quantitative mind than a qualitative. I like math. I like, I like formulas and equations and data, as we talked about. But he was an amazing teacher because he figured out a way to make history and social studies sing to me. Like learning about the Federalist Papers and learning about the history of the country and learning about all of its unevenness, but its commitment to progress. I always was really taken by that. And I think the thing that he really helped to introduce in my own mind, was the importance of policy and everything. And I think that was at the point when I started to understand the importance of it, because you realize that everything in your life is a policy decision, right? From the air we breathe to the water we drink to the homes that we live in to the transportation assets we have to the way we're policed to the schools we're attending. And then I started looking back and thinking about my life and realizing that everything about my life was a policy decision. Someone created a policy frame to make that real. And so I think he was really the first person that opened up my eyes to that and the importance of policy in everything that we do and in every way we exist.
You went from there to, you had these parallel lives going because you were advancing the military. I think you were the youngest commissioned second lieutenant ever. And then you also went on to Johns Hopkins. So you were
right.
You were pursuing your military obligations as well as academic, Johns Hopkins, a Rhodes Scholarship. And so on. In fact, I think you were a paratrooper Rhodes Scholar, which is probably an unusual.
They don't always go together. Huh?
No, they don't. There were times when I was a student when I wished I could parachute out of class. I remember that, but that's a whole different story. And you were there in 2001 when 9/11 unfolded. Was it a weird thing to be sitting there in this very elite academic setting over there in Britain while all of this was unfolding?
It was so stirring because we were one of the first transatlantic flights, one of the first time they were allowing transatlantic flights back after 9/11. I think we left on September 23rd of 2001 to head over to England. And watching how when we were overseas, how just simply existing was enough to spur a conversation with people. You know, one of the amazing things about Oxford was, you know, I was one of few Americans. In my course, I studied international relations and I did a master's and then began the DPhil process in international relations.
And we should say studied the process of radicalization in that part of the world, right?
So, right. My entire thesis was on the rise and ramifications of radical Islamism in the Western Hemisphere, which also, you know, while our focus area was Brazil and Paraguay and Ciudad del Este and different places in South America and Central America. It really did look at where were the origins of that expansion? Where did that come from?
Before we go on with the narrative, let me just ask you in this place, do you see elements, do the things that you studied then, do they ring in your analysis of some of the radicalization that we've seen in our own country? Do you see elements that were relevant to your analysis of what's going on in January 6th and some of that?
It's about this idea of disillusionment is real. And the thing about disillusionment, when you have populations who just feel disconnected, is they are targets, right? They are targets for people who want to use and manipulate that. And I think that there was two really interesting dynamics that I think I took from even that research. You know, one was the importance of border regions, because a lot of the things that I studied was actually looking at border regions. The border of, you know, Brazil and Argentina, the border of Paraguay and Argentina. And the reason that borders became so powerful for people to go into is because no one took accountability, right? Because you could easily say, you could have Paraguay who could easily say, well, that's Argentina's problem. Or Argentina who can simply say, well, that's Brazil's problem. Because in a border region, there's a question of who's accountable for what's happening in that region. Society is actually no different. Because if you have a lack of accountability for who is actually responsible for what we're seeing, you can see how it's very easy to penetrate, very easy to change and manipulate minds. And you also realize at that point, and this was something that we saw, you know, even in Afghanistan, was that if you don't provide pathways for economic inclusion, economic growth, people will do anything. I remember there was a platoon sergeant who was talking about this idea of saying, the most dangerous person that we are going to see out here is someone who hasn't worked for a couple of years, be convinced to do anything. And it's this type of thing that I think was also very, very important. When you watch these pockets where you have not just poverty, but generational poverty, where that is something that's a pastime that's continued being laid down generation after generation, where that level of disillusionment is so real in people's lives, then the ability to try to change or manipulate or tell them what's to blame and who's to blame and the why is so extraordinarily high, which makes every single aspect of our society more dangerous.
We also increasingly have the ability to, and you know, the social media algorithms have been helpful in this. We create these sort of silos, these communities of shared outrage that give people who feel isolated a sense that they're part of something. So you mentioned Afghanistan. You went and you spent 9 months there on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, which was quite a lively place to be. And it makes me, and you were working on sort of economic issues and trying to give people a sense that something was possible there. Obviously, we withdrew from Afghanistan 20 years later. Could that story have ended differently? And if so, how?
There was a few years prior to President Biden making the decision to be able to make a decision to withdraw all forces that I then started calling for us to do exactly that. And I think part of the challenge was that once you get to a point that it's very good, that you can't articulate not just the why, but what become the targets that we're looking for. What is the ask that we're continuing to ask these men and women to make? Then from a policy perspective, you've got to make different decisions. And, you know, I think about what happened in, within Afghanistan and the challenge and the complication of it. It's not just about what happened in that 20 years that we were there. It's what was taking place the 20 years prior.
Right.
And that's the thing I think is really important for people to understand and recognize, because the damage and the challenge of Afghanistan did not happen overnight.
Right. Right.
The fact that we are talking about a place and we're talking about a space and a culture that's been in a constant state of war
right.
for
right.
decades, a sporadic state of war for yeah. centuries.
Right.
The difficulty of being able to understand that is when you're looking at the dynamics and the situation that we saw in Afghanistan, the fact that we were deployed and we were maneuvering in areas where the literacy rate was in the single digits,
right?
When you're looking at those as the very real dynamics of what you're facing, the idea that you're going to have a military solution out of that is naive.
I remember these discussions very well in 2009 when President Obama was trying to think about the pathway forward. And I remember those very difficult discussions, those arguments about what was possible, and people making the same argument that you're making now, which I think turned out to be the right. One of those people who was making that argument was Vice President Joe Biden in the inner councils of the. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I don't want to lose. You know, we there's so much to your story. I don't want to miss it. The main pieces: you got a White House fellowship. You were a special assistant to the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. You sound a little like Zelig. Remember that movie Zelig, the guy who showed up in all these pictures all through history? You spent some time in banking. I remember you spoke at the 2008 Democratic National Convention. I have a special fondness for that particular event. And I'm sure you do. And then in 2011.
You had a lot to do to make that event happen.
Well, you know. I always say the same thing about that. You always look good driving a Maserati. You know what I mean? But you wrote a book that got a tremendous amount of attention called The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. And it was about your journey and the journey of another man named Wes Moore, who had a lot less fortunate path. And just tell me just a little bit about that and how you came across that concept of that book. And then I want to ask you a couple of questions about it.
You know, I remember I was actually overseas, and I just received I'd received a Rhodes Scholarship, and the Baltimore Sun, which my hometown paper, was writing an article about this local kid who had just received the Rhodes Scholarship. And at the same time, they were writing, you know, a whole series of articles about a botched jewelry store robbery. And the more that I dug into what happened, where you had a botched jewelry store robbery where an off-duty police officer was killed, because he was moonlighting as a security guard, at a jewelry store. And there was a 12-day national manhunt for these four guys. And finally, after this manhunt, all four guys were caught. And one of the people that the police were looking for that was eventually captured and tried and convicted and sentenced for the crime was this guy whose name was also Wes Moore. And I was haunted by this idea. And as I continue to learn more about his story and his background, and one day I just decided to reach out and I wrote him a note. And then a month later, I get a letter back from Jessup Correctional Institution, from Wes Moore. And that one letter turned into dozens of letters. Those dozens of letters turned into dozens of visits. And then eventually at some point, a friend of mine who's actually, she's like a real writer. She's like, you know, she writes about a book. She reached out and she's like, I think there's a bigger story here about you and the other Wes Moore. And eventually I remember one day just reaching out to Wes, and I told him that someone approached me about actually writing a story about our, you know, are getting to know each other. And Wes was like, I think you should do it. And he said something that I won't forget. He said two things. He said, one, he said, you know, I've wasted every opportunity I've ever had. And he said, and he said, and if you can do something to help people understand the consequences of their decisions and also do something to help people understand the neighborhoods that these decisions are being made in, then you should do it. And so the story of the other Wes Moore is really fundamentally a story about how thin that line is between our life and someone else's life. How oftentimes, you know, when you look at my journey and my story, and the unevenness of my own history, as we talked about, and the story of the other Wes Moore, that you have a Wes Moore who, as I was getting ready to head off to England on a Rhodes scholarship, the other Wes Moore was getting ready to spend the rest of his life in prison. If we can understand and unpackage these lives, hopefully we can do a better job of being able to, intervene.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now back to the show. I got to touch on a few things that, because if I don't, I'd be remiss. One is you talked about the Baltimore Sun as your hometown paper. But the truth is you didn't spend that. This came up in the campaign, as things do in campaigns when people are trying to defeat you. But the fact that you didn't spend a lot of your life in Baltimore, in fact, very little. You were there as a student at Johns Hopkins, obviously. And so I guess it's no more of a hometown than the Bronx was, right?
You know, I tell you, I think that was actually one thing that people got wrong. And I think it's one thing a lot of the media and the stories got wrong on, where I think when people talk about where are you from, for a lot of people, that's a very easy question. For me, it's not, because I had to move around a lot when I was younger, and it wasn't because of choice. It was because of tragedy. And the reason that I always say, and I will always say, that Baltimore is my hometown, I'm a very proud Baltimorean, is because when my mom got her first job that gave her benefits, first job that allowed her to work one job instead of multiple jobs, that was at a place called the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And that was actually what brought us back and had us leave New York and come back to Maryland. And when I think about that, was it wasn't just that that job changed her life. It changed all of our lives. Because when we go back, and Casey's right in the heart of Baltimore, as my mother said at that point, you know, I could not keep him out of Baltimore, because that was the first time that I actually felt like I found home.
Mm-hmm.
It was like I had a connection. Some of my best and most shaping memories were right in Baltimore. So when my mom gets that first job when I'm 14 years old, and that really becomes very much from that point
home. I hear you. And then the second thing is on the book, which really was critically acclaimed, embraced by Oprah, which is the ultimate authority, as we know, who is the ultimate authority. But there was a reaction from some relatives of the other Wes Moore who claimed that you were exploiting him. There was reaction from family of the police officer who died, you know, with charges of embellishment or so on. So again, I feel obligated to ask you about that.
I think one thing that people see is that there's no one ever claimed that there's anything that I ever wrote or frankly even said that was inaccurate or an embellishment. There's nothing about my life that I have to embellish. Nothing about my childhood, about
about yours. I guess the question was about your relationship with him or some of his story. But anyway, go ahead and correct me.
Yeah, no, but I'm glad you said it, because one thing, and again, I stand by everything that I wrote, everything that I have ever said. And I think about even the, when we're talking about the family, it's frankly a disconnected and extended family member from that is claiming something in a connection, which frankly he cannot or should not claim. But and I think about, you know, what it meant for the larger community, what it meant for, you know, the people within, you know, within this space. It really did become something where, you know, as I've said, I've always been very clear about my my respecting of the privacy of the officer's family, respecting of the privacy for all the people and all the people involved. But nobody can claim that anything that was written or said was either exaggerated or inaccurate. And no one has claimed that.
I mean, you continued your business career, but you went on to become the CEO of the Robin Hood Foundation, which is a poverty-fighting nonprofit in New York. A remarkable program, really. You know, that distributed hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to try and fight poverty and support organizations that were doing that in New York. What drew you to that assignment?
I think the thing that drew me to the assignment was, prior to that, we had I built out a platform and a successful small business that was really focusing on helping first generation students go to and through college. And I think about the work that we were able to do, which was able to, help increase retention by, upwards of 20%. And these are students who, frankly, had a very, very difficult time making the transition, because when you're talking about first generation students going to and through college, it's both financial. It is academic when you're looking at the high propensity of students who have to go into higher education and take developmental coursework and that type of thing. And then it is also just the situation where oftentimes life just gets in the way of students who are first generation students. And, the thing that I saw when Robin Hood first, when they first approached me about it, was this was an opportunity to be able to really rethink how philanthropy works. One of the things I'm really proud of is the fact that we built a policy for the first time in the history of the organization, where the organization had raised and also invested billions of dollars into the work of poverty, early childhood, criminal justice reform, housing, etc., but had never ventured into policy. And oftentimes you'll hear people say, "Well, we don't do politics." But my point is that if you're not addressing the systems, if you're not addressing the policies that people have to exist in, you're just repeatedly going to find yourself cleaning up the debris that comes from those broken systems. And so we actually went out and made sure we were pushing on things like adjustments to the child tax credit, make sure we're pushing on things like making sure that nonprofit organizations and community organizations that were doing the work can actually get paid and get their receivables on time from their municipal partners.
Yeah.
So by you being able to use those levers, it was just a stronger way of being able to use the power of philanthropy as something that can actually drive a real measure of social change.
And you returned to Maryland in 2021. You resigned your position as CEO. You returned to Maryland and launched this campaign for governor. And you've talked about yourself as sort of an atypical a Democrat. And talk to me about that. Talk to me about your fundamental philosophy, because certainly on social, not social, but on social investments, you seem like very much a mainstream kind of progressive Democrat. So talk to me about the nuances of all this.
I think one thing that people, they see and they realize for me is that data matters in all this. And the reason that I take on the reason I believe that we have to address the racial wealth gap, for example, is not because it sounds good. It's because the racial wealth gap has cost this country $16 trillion in GDP over the past two decades, right? And that's not GDP of a group. That is GDP, right? The reason that I say we have to address things like child poverty is not just because the idea that children are coming up in poverty should be breaking our hearts. It's about the propensity for a child who grows up in poverty, for them to be an adult who ends up dying in poverty, is remarkably high. And that has significant economic impacts on all of us. And so I think when I think about my philosophy and the way I try to approach this work, is we were very clear when I launched this campaign. And, I've said where I've been involved in these issues for my entire adult life. I've been a public servant for my whole life. I just haven't been a politician. But I have been someone who's worked deeply in community and with community on these issues. And we knew that we were going to focus on the issues of work, wages, and wealth. And the idea of saying that this is about economics. And when we're talking about work, it means in our case, it means we are going to make sure that we're teaching our young people how not just to be employees, but how to be employers. That I wanted the state of Maryland, and we will be, the first state in this country to offer a service year option for every single high school graduate. When we talk about wages, it means increasing wages so people could actually have a fair, livable wage for the work that they're doing and get rid of the days where you have people who are working jobs, in some cases, multiple jobs, and still living below a poverty line. And when we're talking about wealth, it just simply means the idea that you should be able to own more than you owe, the ability to pass something off to your children besides debt. And so the way I approach that is this is not just a governance philosophy. It really is how I think the data is driving the way that we should think about our policy work.
Yeah. Part of data is budgets and how I think you've also talked about universal pre-K and some other things. And the question is, listen, I associate myself with your priorities. I think they're important. I think that when you talk about public safety and some of these other issues, you know, we tend to think of them rather narrowly. But I'm sitting here on the south side of Chicago, and I know that these problems run much deeper than how many police we have in a particular community or some of the other issues by which we sort of define the whole debate. That said, it costs money. And you've also, I think, talked about being fiscally responsible and so on. So how do you square the circle here? How do you pay for these priorities that are costly and still meet your obligation to balance the budget and be the fiscally prudent steward that you present yourself as?
When I looked at the work that we did, where, you know, we're related with Robinhood, it's one of the largest poverty funding organizations in the country, yet at the same time, what we really prided ourselves on, in my leadership there was we're going to be disciplined in being able to show what is going to be the societal return on every single dollar, right? Every single dollar we could show you what was the societal return on that individual, on the individual investment. And I think it's both understanding that there is a cost to an action, you know, that we will continue paying more on a back end if you're not willing to invest on a front end. But at the same time, it's understanding that we have to be creative and thoughtful about the unique resources that we have on Bear, that we have at Bear right now, where, you know, I think about for the state of Maryland and people look at the initiatives that we are championing and the fact that, you know, that overwhelmingly the state went and, came and supported us, where we won by the largest margin of any Maryland gubernatorial race in over 40 years. It was because we were being very transparent and very coherent with people about not just the things we want to push, but how we're going to pay for them. When we talk about, you know, when we talk about the ability to focus on infrastructure and transportation and not allowing people to come up in transportation desert, knowing that we still have both billions of dollars that are coming in from the federal government, that's specifically earmarked towards transportation infrastructure. The fact that you still do have a structural surplus within the state, that is earmarked for these issues. And then also you have new forms of revenue that are coming on board. What's really important for us and the approach that we took in our campaign and that we will take in our governance is it's not just about how are we going about and spending this. It's about how are we actually investing on things that we know are going to create the largest societal return.
Right, I get that. But you basically feel like under the umbrella of the revenues that you have and that you anticipate, that you can just rearrange priorities and invest more wisely and cover the nut?
We know we can. Because okay. With every single one, and we are very detailed about the proposals, with every single one, we showed what is going to be the economic breakdown in order to make that happen.
I want to talk to you about public safety. And because, first of all, the crime issue was one that Republicans across the country ran on. We've had, and I think a lot, this has been exacerbated by the pandemic, but we do have a public safety crisis in a lot of our communities. You certainly have felt it in Baltimore. Tell me what you think we need to do differently. And obviously, you spoke to part of this in terms of investments and how you... I get frustrated with the idea of this, that public safety and respect for communities is a zero-sum game, that you have to choose one or the other, but you can't do both. And you lived through the Freddie Gray situation in tragedy in Baltimore. Give me your philosophy of all of this and the way forward.
My philosophy is, you're right, we're not going to approach the issue of public safety like it's a zero-sum game. That we have to have policing and police force that moves with appropriate intensity and absolute integrity and full accountability. And that it means we have to be able to put the resources in place that ensure that people have a right to be comfortable and safe in their own communities. And that includes things like, by the way, getting and keeping these violent offenders off our streets and legal guns out of neighborhoods. Yet at the same time, it's understanding that we're not going to police our way out of this, and we're not going to militarize our way out of this. And I think part of the challenge, part of the dynamic, I think about even in my own life, where, you know, where I felt handcuffs to my wrist when I was 11 years old. Cause I came up in areas that were over policed and we knew it. Right. But if someone would have said to that 11-year-old kid, you know, one day you could be a governor, that kid would have never believed you. And so we have to make sure that we're being thoughtful about the things that we're putting in place to actually make an idea of that real. So that includes things like that from a state perspective, where, you know, a third of all violent crime that is taking place in this day and then, here is by people who are in violation of parole and probation. We've got over 150 vacancies in parole and probation right now within the state of Maryland. And so when you're looking at that, that has direct and distinct impacts on our individual communities, because you have people who continue to be unmonitored or unchecked that are continuing to wreak havoc inside of neighborhoods. And so the ability to build out parole and probation, that is a state function. But when you're having the breakdown of basic state agencies, it means that work is not being done. It means communities are left to fend for themselves. It means that you can actually take, you know, if you look at the closure rate, for example, for homicide in the city of Baltimore, the closure rate is 41%. That means if I commit a homicide in Baltimore, I've got a better chance of getting away with it than I do of actually getting caught, tried, captured, and convicted for it. You could take state resources, put them on loan to the city of Baltimore, increase coordination and intelligence sharing, and actually be able to decrease the workload, increase the closure rate, and make communities feel safer. But the thing is, you've got to take that seriously. That's not someone else's problem. And you can't have a situation where cities are left to fend for themselves to be able to address things like the tragic level of violence that we continue to see in our communities without understanding the partnership and the relationship that the state plays in helping to address that as well.
Well, Wes, I could talk to you for a lot longer about these issues and other issues. You've got a government to put together. I'm not even going to close on the, do you think you might run for national office someday, because you would not answer it. And if you did answer it, you wouldn't be worthy of talking to for another hour. So, but it's great to be with you. I wish you the best of luck. And I really look forward to, I hope you'll come to the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago along the way. And I look forward to spending more time with you down the line.
I look forward to making that happen. And this is going to be Maryland's decade. And I think Maryland's going to have a hell of a story to tell over this next decade. And I look forward to getting out to the Institute to come share it with you as well.
Okay. You know, we record this, so at the end of the decade, we're going to check back and see. But
please do. Hold me to it.
Okay. Thanks so much. Best of luck to you.
Thank you for listening to the Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.